The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey there, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. That's the place you're at. That's the place I hope you'll be with for the next hour. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector. I'm the editor of MediaChannel.org, the author of the NewsDissector.com blog, the maker of many films, including Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. Every week at this time, I'm here to hold forth, to embellish and amplify on my blog and about the ideas that are in the news and not in the news. All of that is part of what this program is about. We're followed by the wonderful Irene McGee, who comes in after I'm done, who's a great media literacy analyst, and she'll be talking more about stuff about our media with her guests. But right now I have a very interesting program for you today. We have Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert, who are broadcasters, who are on many different channels, Press TV, RT. They've been on Al Jazeera. They're very well known as financial analysts and commentators. Max is one of the few financial pundits who has actually called the people on Wall Street financial terrorists. And he has been extremely forthright, both in his language and his analysis. He correctly predicted the financial crisis. He was one of the first to spotlight the role of subprime lending. He is somebody who doesn't mince his words. He doesn't basically attempt to portray himself as some reasonable, down the middle, on the one hand, on the other hand, analyst. He tells it like he thinks it is. He's in Paris, and he and Stacey will be joining us via Skype, hopefully, in a few minutes. And then later in the program, we'll be meeting a wonderful woman who I met years ago in Boston, Nancy Gertner. Nancy has been a federal judge, a very high position. She's one of the few women, the first women to be on the federal bench. She was a defense lawyer in Boston for many years. She's a very outspoken lawyer. She's now going from the bench to the Harvard Law School. And she'll be joining us to talk about her new book about women and law. She's extremely accomplished and extremely insightful about these matters, and I'm very happy that Nancy will be able to join us today here on News Dissector Radio on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. If you want to join the conversation, the number to call, toll-free, 888-874-4888. That's, once again, 888-874-4888. We're also going to be hearing some music today. I've decided to start previewing some new music on the program every week. And we'll start off this week with some contemporary acoustic guitar by a friend of mine, Norman Savitt. Norman and friends have just issued a new album on Balkan Samba Records. He's a very talented artist. He's also somebody who's been very engaged in the cultural, countercultural scene in New York for many years. And I'm pleased to be able to showcase at least some of his music. You'll be hearing it on the program for the next hour. So that's Norman Savitt and friends, S-A-V-I-T-T. Now, we're going to start today by looking at one of the big news stories, and there's a picture in the front page of the New York Times you're not going to believe. It's an eerie red, okay? It's across the front page. It says, special delivery for Libya from the British Royal Air Force, okay? And when we look at the plane, we don't really get what is it? What are we looking at? There's a bunch of guys standing on the side of basically a bunch of packages, boxes of money. Britain has released $1.6 billion in unfrozen banknotes, and they're bringing it to Libya. I don't know if they're going to bomb the country with the money or not, but they're bringing it to Libya on this giant plane, military plane, surrounded by all these soldiers. It's a fantastic picture. It's a great image of the transfer of all this money back to Libya, supposedly unfrozen banknotes that they froze, of course, which had to do with oil that they probably sold to Libya or agreed to sell, or rather oil Libya sold to them. They got the oil now, then they didn't froze the money to pay for it. Now they giving the money to the so-called rebels in Libya. Yesterday in Paris, Hillary Clinton and a whole bunch of Western leaders were there to decide what's next for Libya. In other words, don't think this decision is being made in Tripoli by Libyans. Oh, no. This is being made in part by the NATO powers that actually bombed Libya into submission, although Colonel Gaddafi says he's fighting on, he's resisting. We'll see what's going to happen. It's not over yet, let's say that for sure. But one of the interesting angles on all this is the front page article of the New York Times, which says, in Libya, former enemy is recast in role of ally. Military council chief declares he has no Islamic agenda. Fascinating. Then you turn to an article by Arnaud de Boisgrave, who was for many years a neocon and became increasingly skeptical of U.S. policy. He's now an editor-at-large for United Press International. And he has a commentary called Global Con? And listen to this. Were the United States, France, Britain, Belgium, Denmark, Norway, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, the NATO-led coalition that set out to overthrow Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's regime, snookered by Al-Qaeda? A preposterous scenario with some disturbing factual elements. In the early 1900s, when James Woolsey was the director of the CIA, Gaddafi appealed to the U.S. for assistance against what he called Islamic extremists, which he described as more threatening, than any opposition forces. And they were all based in the Benghazi region of Libya. Now, none of this really got the public attention. Mostly people don't know what Gaddafi is talking about anyway. And he was saying that, yeah, there are these extremists, by which he meant Al-Qaeda-type elements, in the Benghazi region. Now, Woolsey is one of the leaders of a campaign exposing a plot, supposedly, to bring Sharia law to America, which he says is more threatening than communism. Now, the investigative reporter behind uncovering the gigantic Libyan con is someone who's been on this program, none other than Emilio Pepe Escobar, who's from Brazil, who's a fantastic reporter for the online Asia Times. And he's been writing breaking stories all over the Middle East for years. One of the things he's now basically discussing is his view that a man named Abdel Hakim Belhaj, who is not really too widely known but is mentioned in the front page of the Times today, was a Al-Qaeda operative. And he actually was arrested in Malaysia and held there and then renditioned Libya and to the United States, where he was to Libya, where he was tortured, okay, by the CIA. At any rate, this guy, who the United States had really labeled an enemy operative, an Al-Qaeda person, is now the head of the military council in Libya. Ooh, ooh, ooh. What is this going to mean? Okay, so here we have an angle on this whole story that is completely has been sort of unreported. Who are, we've been asking for weeks, months now, who are the Libyan rebels? Who do they consist of? What do they want? What is their social base? What is their political objectives? And mostly, it's been, response has been sort of, well, they're freedom fighters, they're against this nasty Gaddafi. But, you know, there's so much more to this story, as there always is, because whenever you talk about war, you talk about propaganda, and that means that truth is hard to find. If you're interested in another view of the whole situation in Libya, take a look at a website by Bill Blum, B-L-U-M, who's written a lot about the CIA. It's called killinghope.org. And he talks a lot about the motives and the modus operandi of the NATO powers and what they've actually done in Libya and to Libya. At any rate, this guy is now apparently been on the CIA's radar since 9/11. He was arrested in Malaysia, transferred to a secret Bangkok prison, and tortured. According to this report by our friend Pepe Escobar in 2004, U.S. intelligence decided to send him as a gift to Libyan intelligence until he was freed by the Gaddafi regime in March 2010, along with 211 so-called terrorists, in a public relations coup that was advertised at the time with great fanfare. So now, apparently, we have a situation where these rebels, whole situation is extremely murky. There are definitely people there, including the head of their military council, having had links with not only Al-Qaeda, but also with Swahiriri, who's, I'm sorry if I mispronounce it, bin Laden's deputy, the Egyptian doctor who is now number one in Al-Qaeda. So we have a situation here where one of the rebel leaders was assassinated recently. Escobar reports that the top military commanders working with NATO are all part of this group called LIFG, which was calling for a jihad against Gaddafi and also against the United States and Western infidel. Escobar concludes that it does not require a crystal ball to picture the consequences here. Having conquered military power and being among the war's winners, will these people relinquish control just to please NATO and form some sort of democratic state in Libya? Or is there much more to this that we don't know? So this is just Debochkarov calls a harem-scarum scenario of NATO snookered by Al-Qaeda affiliates. And the only one who could be pleased by this, he says, is China. So, again, whenever we look at these things, it's never simple. It's never black and white. We're waiting for Max. We don't have him yet. Hope we don't have either of them through the power and wonders of Skype, but we may be up against something more serious than Skype, that is to say the traffic in Paris, where it's now 7 p.m., it's rush hour. Can they get there in time? And so we're going to hopefully be joined by Max and Stacy in a few moments, the fascinating analysts. But right now, let's start off with a little music from Norman Savage and Friends. Savage and Friends, Balkan Samba Records. This is a new album of contemporary acoustic guitar, certainly worth listening to and having. So I wanted to share a little of it. We'll have some more in the program as we continue. Of course, the best-made plans of men and mice often don't come to fruition, so here we are without our lead guests. Hopefully they'll join us. We have our trusty engineer trying every number he has, every email account he has, trying to Skype Max and Stacy. So if and when they join us, they'll be on the program. Hopefully we'll have them back if there's not enough time. Today we'd certainly like to open the phones for any calls you might have about the situation in Libya, 888-874-4888. This is important, of course, because this has been capturing a tremendous amount of media attention and reports that, you know, have also been, it seems to me, very deceptive, you know, from the very beginning when it was basically suggested that this whole operation would take but a weekend, you know, and that it was all there to protect the civilians of Libya, whose needs seem to have been forgotten. The Western allies, NATO et al., are basically saying the Gaddafi regime, it's always a regime when you don't like them. The Gaddafi regime basically has killed a lot of civilians and are responsible for exaggerating estimates of people caught up in so-called collateral damage through NATO bombing. But, of course, NATO show has not released any figures, to my knowledge, about how many people they admit to having killed in Libya. So that war continues. In the meantime, a new war has started in Yemen, where it's being told how wonderful it is that no American troops were killed in Iraq this past month, the first in a long time. But, of course, many Iraqis were killed in that country. Situation in Afghanistan seems to be continually stalemated, and we're in a situation, you know, there where Mr. Petraeus, making one of his last trips before he becomes the head of the CIA, Mr. Petraeus is saying, oh, no, we can't cut the military, no way. You know, so you can see the military brass, the Pentagon power, the contractors, the various companies that manufacture weaponry beginning to form their lobby, their defensive line against any cutbacks in military spending. That's very likely. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports today that the mission of the CIA that Petraeus is about to take over has been changed. Basically to a death squad. Essentially, their role now is to kill people we don't like. It's part of what's called counterterrorism program. Apparently, the success of the killing of bin Laden has led to other killings and will continue to lead to more killings. So we have a situation here where the CIA itself is becoming more of, essentially a government-sanctioned death squad. And that's in the Washington Post today, if you doubt me. It's not propaganda, it's reporting. And it's something that should be of concern, because once they start killing people in other countries, there's very little to stop them from blowing back, if you will, and killing people in our own country, which has happened, as many people suspect or fear, in the past, with, suggestions of various plots by the CIA, and, still very vivid. I mean, most Americans do not accept the government version of the Kennedy assassination to this day, and that was back in 1963. So suspicions remain. Evidence may not be, completely undisputed or undebated, but certainly there's a great deal of skepticism and suspicion about anything the CIA claims and anything that is claimed on its behalf. Meanwhile, our president, to shift now to the domestic front, and I'm writing a piece about this that should be up this weekend as we approach Labor Day weekend, with new job report that's just come out saying that no new jobs were created. Emphasis, none, zero, zilch, nada. And that means that at the same time as our friend Max Wolf points out on Huffington Post, there has been a lot of destruction of jobs, not creation of jobs. And the destruction of jobs is taking place at the local level. School teachers are losing their jobs. The people who teach our children are losing their jobs in large numbers. And those were kind of middle-class jobs, in some cases union jobs, where there were benefits and protections. So now what we see is basically the people in the middle class are being whacked, and, going on unemployment with very little chance of getting new jobs. So, again, the economy is shrinking in terms of growth. Its role is nobody seems to know what to do. Now, next week, not in prime time as far as I can see, but at 7 p.m. Eastern time, which was always a special sort of access time. It wasn't considered prime time by the networks anyway, which always started, said prime time begins at 8 p.m. But now at 7 p.m., because of the intervention of Mr. Boehner, the House a majority leader, and a negotiation with the White House, the president's desire to give a speech at 8 o'clock on Wednesday has been pushed back to Thursday at 7 p.m. So now we have to wait another day for the president to reveal to us his plan for creating jobs. There's been intimations of various tax benefits for companies who create jobs. There's been talk of a national infrastructure bank at a time when the whole banking system is if not in collapse, certainly in crisis. So it doesn't seem as if they really know what to do. Our number, 888-874-4888, if you know what to do about this jobs crisis, because, I have seen very little. One of the things I mentioned in this new article, which is quite fascinating, is that a banker, I think from UBS, the Swiss bank, has quoted as an expert on this whole issue, Karl Marx. He says Marx had the solution, and he talks about how Marx wanted to create jobs and you know, offers an analysis of why we dismiss Marxism at our peril. This is not me saying it. This is a banker saying it. So, you know, the twists and turns are becoming more and more fascinating. You know, Obama is facing a very serious situation politically. New polls show a growing disaffection with, you know, with him and his stance, which is trying to please kind of everyone but pleases no one. He's a man in the middle, so to speak. He's trying as best he can, you know, to placate the public, to seem to be the responsible, you know, official, you know, not a crazy, but in fact, a lot of the people in his base, the people who voted for him, worked for him, who sweated for him, who were so happy when he succeeded to become president, are now increasingly disaffected, disillusioned, and upset with him. And this means that that's going to make it much harder for Obama to get reelected, that's for sure. If a lot of people sit on their hands and don't vote, we're likely to have a repetition of what happened, you know, in 2008, where the Tea Party was successful because so many of the Obama voters did not turn out at the polls. So anyway, we now have Max Keiser with only 5 minutes to go. We're going to try to reschedule, and then we'll bring Nancy in a little bit later. Max, are you with us?
Yeah, sure, Danny. Nice to hear from you.
Well, you know, how is that Paris traffic in getting home? Was that the problem, or is it just... You know,
well, we just started up our third week show edition. We do three shows now for RT, the Keiser Report with Max Keiser and Stacey Herbert. So our taping and broadcasting schedule just got a lot busier.
Well, here you are, Max Keiser, formerly a stockbroker here in America, formerly a film producer. You've been working in finance for, it says, 25 years. You've been denounced as Mad Max by the Guardian newspaper. You've been criticized by many for using overheated language, like referring to financial capitalists as terrorists. You've been at the same time right on a number of major predictions, including the financial crisis. I believe you were one of the first to see that coming in 2004, to actually also to discuss the role of subprime lending and the rest of it. So where are we, Max? We just had a jobs report showing no new jobs created this past month in the United States of America. Are we on the way down?
Well, the system is still being held hostage by the bankers. You know, the 2008 bailout did nothing to ameliorate the situation. It merely was a salve to temporarily make things look as though they were functioning again, but it did nothing to address the underlying fundamental problem of predatory bankers, if you will, bankers who own the regulatory agencies that are supposed to oversee them, bankers who make extraordinarily risky bets, and every time they make a losing bet, they get the government in either the U.S. or the U.K. or in Europe or elsewhere to impose austerity measures to pay off their bad bets. In the parlance of gambling, this is called a Martingale betting system. In other words, if you go to the roulette wheel and you bet red every single bet until you win, you can make money that way, but you have to have unlimited capital. And this is exactly what the bank's message to the government is. They will continue to make risky bets with unlimited capital that they draw from the taxpayer until they win. And meanwhile, if they get any losing bets, those are passed on to the population in the form of austerity measures. So this is it's beyond what you heard last year or the year before. It's capitalism for them, socialism for us. Or it's they keep the winners, we take the losers. It's gone even beyond that now. Now it's just a straight up and down, you know, highway robbery. It's just a smash and grab. They're just smashing the system and stealing the money with credit default swaps, for example. If you have a bank like Société Générale in France is about to go bankrupt, well, the bondholders are going to lose money, their shareholders are going to lose money, but the predatory fund managers who own the credit default swaps are going to make double or triple those losses by engaging in these corrupt transactions in the so-called shadow banking system and other areas of the banking system that, again, is completely unregulated.
Well, what do you make of, you know, there have been calls for years now for the federal government here to prosecute financial criminals on Wall Street, to take them to task, not just Bernie Madoff, who had very little to do, if anything, with this financial crisis, but the big banks who profited from the crisis. And there's been no action taken. Now today, the New York Times is reporting U.S. is set to sue dozen big banks over mortgages, move expected in days, agency seen as arguing that lenders lacked due diligence. Is this a case of, too little, too late?
Well, the banking sector in any healthy economy should never make up more than 5 to 10% of the GDP at most. In America and around the world, the banking sector now makes up 50 to 60% of the GDP of the G20 nations. And what the bankers are saying is that fraud has become the de facto business model in these countries. If you stop us from committing fraud, then your entire economy collapses. And they're absolutely right. The fraudulent banking system of extracting fees by trading faulty, unregulated, toxic securities has become the biggest profit and cash flow on Wall Street, therefore, for America itself.
I've written about this, Max, in a book called The Crime of Our Time, about the criminal nature of this financial crisis. I see it as a crime story like you do, but so far I haven't made this connection that without crime, the economy couldn't function at all. That's pretty...
Well, look at, Danny, let's go to that story that was just a few months old. Wachovia Bank, which was now part of Wells Fargo, which is now a huge investment of Warren Buffett, they were caught red-handed laundering $380 billion of Mexican drug lord cash. As a result of that investigation and prosecution, they had to pay a fine of, I believe it was something on the order of $20 million, which is the same thing as saying they weren't fined at all.
It's like now, a they slap were on the wrist.
$380 billion of Mexican drug lord money, and this is out in the open. Nobody refutes this. Wachovia, Wells Fargo is not saying that this is not what happened. Warren Buffett isn't saying this isn't what happened. Everyone knows this is exactly what happened. And this is interesting. I don't know if you saw this or not, but leading up to the 2008 crisis, it was exactly this deal with Wachovia Bank who was laundering the money for the Mexican cambios, the cash charging establishment, the money changing establishments in Mexico. They were investigating the cambios in Wachovia. The drug lords of Mexico said, we're going to cut the cash off. And the crisis in America ensued. To get the banks rolling again in 2009, we now know that they had to get these drug lords to turn the cash taps back on.
So essentially, this is a lot more complex than certainly American media is telling us. This is a global system, not just an American problem. Most of us think of it just as an American problem, but it's a global set of issues, and that offshore so-called banking and investing and moving money has not been a topic that's gotten a lot of attention, has it?
Well, I don't know why, because to subsidize this criminality, the Federal Reserve has had to bring interest rates down to zero. That means that all the grandmothers and grandfathers, anyone living on a pension account, is getting zero return on their monthly retirement accounts. That's because that money is needed to fund this criminal activity. So I know, for example, in my own family, I've got relatives who are making $3,000 or $4,000 a month in interest income off their treasury bonds. Now they get zero. Why? Because that money is being used to finance criminal behavior. And it's causing a lot of duress in the economy. Anyone who is getting near zero on their pension account and retirement account has to understand that the reason they're getting 0% is because that money is being used to fuel a corrupt criminal mafia economy. And I'm surprised. My feeling is that if more of these retired folks aren't up in arms about having their money stolen like this blatantly, it's not for me to tell them how to run their lives. But I don't know why they would not feel. A lot of them blame themselves. A lot of older people who now get nothing on retirement, they blame themselves, and they have very low self-esteem, and they don't really care to get into any kind of confrontation. Because after all, they're elderly, and it's hard for them to do so. But that's the way America treats its elderly. They throw them under the bus, they steal their money, and they run off with it. And it's sad, but that's what America's come to.
Those seem to be the real death panels there, not the ones that the Republicans talk about. But, you know, to continue this, you know, the time of this whole Greek crisis as it developed, you began talking about financial terrorism. What did you mean by that?
Well, if you compare, let's say, Lloyd Blankfein, who runs Goldman Sachs, with, let's say, a terrorist, someone who we agree is a terrorist, like Bin Laden. First of all, they believe they're doing God's work. Bin Laden said he's doing God's work. Lloyd Blankfein says he's doing God's work. Second of all, they misinterpret their holy book. Bin Laden misinterprets the Quran. Lloyd Blankfein misinterprets Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, selectively reading passages to serve his view of the world. Third, they're willing to kill themselves and their fellow population in the quest of their ideology. Lloyd Blankfein's willing to kill himself and his fellow bankers to satisfy his need for martyrdom as he pursues his ideology of market fundamentalism. This is to believe that market is God. And we saw this on 9/11, Danny Schechter. We know when the first tower went down, there were brokers in the second tower trading options on airline puts, speculating on trying to make money instead of escaping and saving their lives. These brokers died in the collapse because they couldn't stop speculating on airline puts, even though the building right next door had just collapsed. That's the kind of financial terrorist mentality that runs Wall Street and runs America and runs Obama.
That's a suicide bomber right there. Now, you know, Max, you and I have been in and around the media for a long time. You made films. And yet now you seem to be forced into exile, and maybe I'm forced into internal exile because, you know, I'm interviewed more on Press TV out of Iran, RT out of Russia, Al Jazeera out of Doha, than I am out of any of the networks I used to work for. I worked for ABC. I worked for CNN. I worked for even CNBC. None of them have any interest at all in what I have to say. What's your view of this, of our media system? Because, you know, you are seen all over the world on networks that probably have bigger audiences than the American networks, and yet, you know, you're not really part of the debate in the United States.
Well, I'm willing to continue my work as journalist exposing these stories, along with Stacey Herbert, who really, for example, put together the pieces on this Mexican drug cartel story. But it doesn't mean I have to also suffer by living in the United States. I'd rather live in a country like France with the highest standard of living in the world, the best healthcare system in the world, the best food in the world. So this is the way I reward myself for my efforts. I wouldn't want to live in the United States and report on the United States at the same time. That would be too much to suffer, too much to bear.
That's a good answer. Is Stacey there? Can we say hi to her?
She was, and then she just slipped out into the other room.
All right. Well, we know Stacey Herbert is very conscientious, works with you. Yes, Stacey, come on and say hello to the listeners here on the News Dissector Radio. We want them to meet you.
Hi, Danny Schechter and all your listeners. I visit newsdissector.org all the time.
There you go. Stacey, you know, working with Max, is he as mad as they say? You know, he's described as Mad Max in a number of different publications and what have you. People don't want to, you know, think he's a bomb thrower. How serious is he about the work he does?
Oh, he's very serious. But, you know, I do find that whenever I point a camera at him, he does perform more. He does go a little bit crazy. So whenever I need him to wake up a bit, I just take out my camera and start talking to him with that.
Stacey, you know, what's your observations in terms of the feedback that you get on your shows? You must get a lot of response from people around the world. I mean, you're seen on Russia Today. You're seen on Press TV. You've been seen on Al Jazeera. What do people make of what you have to say, and what kind of response do you get?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the internet has equalized it all, really, Danny, because our show, even though, yes, we're on RT, Press TV, Al Jazeera, when we were just in New York in August, everywhere we went throughout Manhattan, everybody recognizes all over the place, all over North Carolina. And a lot of people, yeah, saw it on cable, but they're watching it on YouTube, and they want that information. And so the response has been very positive, and everybody's always so happy to be able to have the sort of information that doesn't get talked about in the national, the U.S. national press, of course.
That's an incredible phenomenon. Stacy, Max, could you stay with us for a little while? Things are a little screwy on our end. We had some guests. They're not here. You weren't here. Could you stay with us for a couple of seconds? We'll be back in a minute with more. Here's some more Norman Savitt. For the Middle, Norman Savitt and Friends, his new CD, Balkan Samba Records. Thank you so much, Norman, for making the music and letting us preview it, premiere it here on the News Dissector Radio. Back to Paris now with Max Kaiser. The number here, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, if you want to talk to Max or Stacy Herbert. Max, President Obama is set to give a job speech next week. It was to have been in prime time. Now it's at 7 p.m., which is not really technically prime time, on Thursday instead of Wednesday, because the Republicans basically nixed him speaking on Wednesday. But what do you expect to hear from him, and what do you think that it will lead to?
Well, the jobs picture in the U.S. is quite dire because, the banking sector has crowded out the productive economy. Has crowded out the ability to create real jobs with real wages. And again, to get back to that 0% interest rate, not only does it hurt savers and pensioners, but it hurts wage earners, because that 0% interest rate means that corporations have no use for American workers when they can simply outsource overseas and get their cash working on their balance sheet, working with exotic derivative arbitrage schemes that are highly illegal and completely unregulated. There's no need for American workers. It's because capital has replaced any form of manufacturing or any value added that America can produce. And it's similar to what you see in the Middle East. In Saudi Arabia, for example, they have the oil business. They don't need their population. They give them all a stipend, but there it's basically a feudalism economy. And in the U.S., it's approaching feudalism as well. There's no need for Americans, for the banks don't need them. That's why they're cutting all their services. That's why they're disenfranchising them. That's why they're impoverishing them. The banks have no need for Americans. They're all being pushed into prisons and at an alarming rate. And so why give them jobs? What's the point? You're only going to give them ideas about, taking a piece of the pie, and the bankers don't want to give up any of that pie. They just want more of that pie. So I don't see the jobs improving. The jobs picture, predictably, just keeps getting worse and worse because of this predatory banking sector. Until Obama ring fences or shuts down the banks, similar to what happened during the S&L crisis in the 1980s, that they created the Resolution Trust Corporation, $600 billion of bad debt was ring-fenced, and the economy was able to grow again because the cancer was curtailed.
And also,
so far, that hasn't happened.
Also, let's not forget, 1,500 or more bankers went to jail after that SNL crisis, and you know, banks basically funded, you know, tremendous lobbying effort to ensure that that will never happen again. Excuse me, Max. Excuse me, Stacy. We have to run now, but I just wanted to thank you so much for coming on the air with us. I hope you'll do it again. Where can people see you again, just those that don't know your work? I mean, you were just here, and you claim, you, even though you didn't see me, millions of people saw you. So tell me about where they can see you, what time your shows are on.
Well, maxkeiser.com, K-E-I-S-E-R, is the website. You can follow me on Twitter, Max Keiser on Twitter. Or you can follow Stacey Herbert on Twitter, and we actually are using that more and more to keep people in touch with what we're doing. Stacey might have another thought on that.
No, that's the best place to do it, maxkeiser.com, and we post all of our content there.
So thank you, Stacey. Thank you, Max. Hope to see you soon and talk some more perhaps about some of the work that I've been doing in this area as well. So Max Keiser, Stacey Herbert, we're going to be continuing financial analysis on the show. Next week, we have a very exciting guest, and we're going to hear about it right now from Kat. Tell us who's coming on.
Yeah, for next week, we have Naomi Prinz, she was a manager at Goldman Sachs. She's writing new books, and we're really excited to have her next Friday, September the 9th, 1 o'clock.
Naomi Prinz, brilliant. She's in my film, Plunder, the Crime of Our Time. You won't want to miss that. She's fantastic. Now we're shifting a little bit. We're moving. We're moving from Paris, France, to New Hampshire to visit with Nancy Gertner. Nancy Gertner, Judge Gertner. I don't know if she still keeps that honorific now that she's retired from the bench, or she's announcing her intention to retire from the bench this month. She's going to be gone as a U.S. federal judge in the United States District Court for the District of Massachusetts. But Nancy was a defense lawyer. She's a incredibly respected, you know, advocate for women in the law. She's up in New Hampshire, and she's joining us today, telling us about her new book, which we'll get to in a minute. But Nancy, did you guys survive Hurricane Irene up there?
Well, we did. I was back in Boston when the hurricane hit. And I have retired. I retired as of Wednesday, and I've joined the faculty at Harvard Law School. So I can keep the title judge as long as people understand that R-E-T is after it, and that means retired and not retarded.
Well, that's good to know. And Nancy, you've also written a new book. Can you tell us about that? Because it seems very exciting.
When I was waiting to be confirmed as a judge, I was supposed to go through all of my stories to figure out what would embarrass the president. Literally, all judges have to do that. That's the nature of the confirmation process. And since I didn't think that, given my record, I would actually ever be confirmed, the stories began to form themselves into an autobiography about my practice. And then I was confirmed, much to my surprise, and it took me 6 years to write the book. But the best way to describe the book is in the opening chapter. I talk about a panel discussion that I'm on with Sonia Sotomayor and me, talking about how do you become a judge. And Sotomayor begins, and she says, you graduate a fancy law school, you do very well, you work for the government and you work for a firm, you have ideas, but you're cautious about expressing them, and you become a judge. And then it was my turn. And I said, as you know, Danny, since we go back a long time, I said, first you represent the first lesbian feminist radical revolutionary accused of killing a police officer for the anti-war effort you confined. That would be your first case on prime time. You do every abortion case in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, every high-profile case you can find. And then for the final coup de grace, you marry the ACLU, and then you become a judge. So that's what the book is about.
So you're one of those liberal terrorists, I guess, on the bench. But, you know, I mean, this whole process of becoming a federal judge, was there a lot of controversy about your appointment?
You know, there's a set of stories about 17 years ago when I became a judge, and and a set of stories about today. There certainly was controversy. Anyone who had expressed an opinion about the issues of the day was bound to get an enormous amount of opposition. It's much worse today. I don't even think my name would have been mentioned as a judge, let alone confirmed today. And you know, more's the pity. Everyone has to change when they become a judge. Everyone has to move to neutral, essentially. And the notion that we believe that prosecutors and corporate lawyers can do so, but defense lawyers and civil rights lawyers can't, is really very troubling and distorts who gets on the bench.
Well, isn't the part of the kind of theory, anyway, of all of this, of justice in America, it's sort of an advocacy system where, you know, prosecutors advocate for the state, defense lawyers advocate for their clients, there's a dispute about the facts, there's a debate about the character of the person, and out of all of this, a judge or a jury determines the outcome of the case, so that the idea of advocacy is welcome, diversity of viewpoint is supposedly welcome, but when we get onto the bench, it seems like a lot of that disappears, it looks like to me anyway, with more and more conservatives packing the courts.
Well, you're actually saying two things. I mean, it is the job constrains you. There's no question about it. The role constrains you and the law that you're supposed to apply constrains you. The notion, though, that you're not searching for justice, whichever side you're on, is, of course, ridiculous. Everyone approaches judging from a certain context. You know, when you decide whether a witness is credible, what you're really saying is that in my experience, I find him to be believable. Credible is a concept that is very much tied to what your experiences are. When, there's all these concepts like a reasonable man or whether or not the claim was plausible. The notion that you can make those decisions without a context and without life experience is, you know, I think is ridiculous. We all come to these with a life experience. You struggle. I mean, candidly, I had to struggle with the advocacy of my previous life. There were many, many times that I thought the right outcome was X, and I read the latest Supreme Court case, and it was clear that X could not be accomplished. I didn't stop believing that that was the right outcome.
Well, did lawyers who came before you try to get you to recuse yourself because of your background, because they presumed you to be biased in some way?
Well, they actually, at the very beginning, that was done on occasion, but they really can't do that. I mean, if you look at the Supreme Court, for example, I think it's Justice Roberts who had worked for for Rehnquist in the administration, and there had been memos that he had written. If we choose judges in their 40s and 50s, the notion that you never had an opinion, you can't recuse people based on that because people have had lives. People certainly tried to do that, but I mean, candidly, over time, I think I proved to people that I was going to struggle with the law. And
let me just take you through a case here in New York, which I'm sure you know about. You know, I don't know if you can opine on it because you don't know all the facts, and neither does anybody else, it seems like.
Right, there you go.
Okay, but you know, here we have this Dominique Strauss-Kahn case,
right.
And the maid, you know, in a New York hotel, she's claiming he assaulted her, raped her, or, you know, abused her sexually. He says, no, not true. The prosecution announces that they're going to go forth. The man is held, remanded to custody initially, and then basically forced to wear a bracelet, presumed guilty, certainly in the public eye and in the media eye. I mean, he was, this guy, I mean, couldn't get anybody to say a nice word about him. He was basically presumed to be, you know, a vicious bull, which he might have been, you know, we don't know. And the woman is certainly a victim, and she was called the victim at first because we didn't even know her name because of protecting a woman who's a victim, her ability to, you know, make allegations and not have to be, humiliated, presumably, because of a sexual assault. And then the prosecution is basically announcing that it believes this woman, it's taking the case, and then suddenly it reverses itself, finds discrepancies in what she told them at different occasions, and then announces that they cannot prosecute the case because they do not believe in her guilt. Is this a fair summary of what the media anyway tells us about the case?
I think so. It's a fair summary of the press, right.
Okay.
I mean, I think, you know, this is complicated in so many ways. I mean, on the one hand, we've spent years undoing the perception that women who claim sexual assault are lying. The presumption was that they were lying. And a case like this, particularly against a high-status man, would not have been brought 25, 30 years ago.
Period.
So the fact that they were willing to bring the charges and not assume her, her lack of credibility is an indication of really what the women's movement has done. But by the same token, I saw this as a judge, I saw this as a lawyer, instances in which the government puts forward witnesses that are shaky, that are, you know, shady is actually the better word. And they will say to the jury all the time, you know, we don't, when you're dealing with crime, you have to deal with people who are sometimes shady, and that's the best case the government can make. I always wondered about that. If the government wondered about someone's credibility, why are they bringing the case? So I think that there are two sides to this, and I'm not sure where.
All right, well,
where to be.
Well, I would just say, obviously, you know, you want to be on the side of the truth and the side of the facts. Obviously, here's the case of an African woman who went through, had legitimate fears of or went through female genital mutilation, who obviously, you know, embellished her story because of, you know, claiming to be a rape victim, which turned out not to be the case, or at least is questionable. But it just seems to me a prosecution that takes a sort of self-righteous stance. We can't bring this case because we don't believe in the guilt, when we have had so many cases of innocent people being, you know, kind of convicted of cases by prosecutors who didn't apply that standard. It seems like they just wanted a conviction, and, you know, they will get it any way they can.
Right, but you don't want to encourage that. In other words, you don't want to be in a situation where the prosecution doesn't exercise some discretion as to when they, you know, when they go forward. The prosecution, when they choose to go forward, they have an enormous amount of power, and you want someone to have exercised some judgment at the get-go. You don't want that judgment to be, resoundingly against people who are poor and of color. I understand that, but that's why I don't know which is the right way to go in this case. I can see it on both sides. It was great to have brought the charges because that hadn't been the case. But by the same token, there have been so many wrongful convictions in this country that you really want the prosecution to step back and say, can I credibly make this argument to the jury? You don't want credibility determinations to be determined by race and gender. That may be a problem.
You know, among Nancy's clients, the woman suing the psychiatrist who had repeatedly molested her, another on trial for murdering her abusive husband, a female stockbroker suing Merrill Lynch for discrimination and sexually explicit parties. Over the years, she's also represented a student accused of rape, the mayor's deputy on a trial of extortion, and the brother implicated in the famous or infamous Charles Stewart murder of his pregnant wife in Boston. She's now written this amazing book, In Defense of Women, from Beacon Press. It's described as a one-of-a-kind memoir of an exceptional self-described outsider lawyer. We've been delighted to have you on with us today. You were a President Clinton appointee. You're on the bench in Boston. I think all of the people in Massachusetts basically don't realize how your absence on the bench might lead to a situation of less justice in the courts. But I wish you well at Harvard Law, and I wish you well with your book, In Defense of Women. Thank you so much for joining us today here on News Dissector Radio. Nancy Gertner, everybody, thank you. You can join us every day on newsdissector.com, the blog that I write. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org with your comments and thoughts. You can check out the podcast of this program on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website, and also I'll be posting it in my blog as well as soon as I receive it from the folks here at PRN. So another day, another show, another week. Hopefully we'll have some more Nomi Prinz next week here on NewsDissector.com. Thank you for joining us. We're going to go out with the anthem, the debt anthem from my film In Debt We Trust, and welcome Irene McGee, who's standing by.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo's Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa. We